What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another super special episode here on the Smack Hospitality Podcast. And this episode is a doubleheader with Lydia Forte and Sir Rocco Forte. And we recorded this episode on Sir Rocco's birthday at the Browns Hotel in London. We talked about F&B, how the Rocco Forte Hotel Collection develops new F&B concepts in their hotels, what the unique things are to see and believe when you run a family business, what the future holds for the Rocco Forte Hotel Collection, and how luxury has changed over time. Enjoy the show. Yeah, before I start, first of all, thank you both for doing this and for being here. I realize it's not an everyday chance that people get. I want to ask a question to begin with. The very first thing that I read on the website of Rocco Forte, because obviously we try and do a little bit of research, is four generations of hospitality, and about the fourth or fifth word that comes up is service. And I've been lucky enough to have been to a couple of Rocco Forte hotels, and I was going to ask you first, Sir Rocco. Service in the time that you've been around in hospitality, has it changed? Is it still the same service as it was when you started, or perhaps when you got and when you first stuck your nose in your dad's business? How has service kind of evolved and changed over time? Has it, is a question.
The concept of service hasn't changed, and in luxury hotels, it's about delivering personalized service to the guest, a bespoke service, so you don't treat every guest the same. It's not like going to the supermarket. If you particularly if he's a regular customer, you understand his needs, and you can deliver them to him before he asks. That hasn't changed. The whole concept of that hasn't changed. What has changed is the way you deliver it.
Yeah,
and sort of with modern techniques and so on, and the way you get to understand the guest's needs.
Yeah,
In the modern world, it's to some degree easier to understand that and actually deliver it on a consistent basis.
Yeah.
But you also talked a lot about when you were starting out about delivering friendlier service and having service that was not casual, but more informal in its approach to the customer and not...
Yes, because in luxury hotels, there was a certain pomposity in the way service was delivered. And unless the customer was very important, some of the staff tended to look down on the customer and said, well, you're not important for us to really worry about.
Yeah.
And when I started Rocco Forte Hotels, I really wanted to change that approach and deliver a service that was much friendlier. And there was a much more lighter engagement between the staff and the customer, and a friendly approach. Same time, the service had to be very professional and correct.
Yeah, and if we talk about luxury today, Lydia, has luxury changed? Is luxury still the same thing as it was, or is it maybe consumed differently than it previously has? Because clearly, when we talk about Rocco Forte hotels, there's a synonym there for luxury, and the way that's developed over time has clearly shaped what you guys do as well, no?
I mean, there's a lot of buzzwords that people talk about now in luxury. You know, the big theme has been experiential luxury, and that people want to have wonderful experiences and do things which are unique and original and really get to know the cities in a way that they didn't necessarily before, and do sort of local activities. All this adventure travel has come out, and these, you know, amazing luxury cruises to the North Pole and the Antarctic. And I think that is the case, and luxury has definitely moved away from just purchasing very nice objects to having to people wanting to spend their money on having these amazing experiences, which has served luxury hospitality very well.
If we talk about, let's talk about F&B for a second and link that kind of to luxury as well, has F&B become more luxurious? Is probably the wrong way of putting it, but has F&B become more of relevance in recent times, or has it always been right up there, or has it kind of developed along with everything else that's developed in hospitality?
I think for luxury hotels, it has become more relevant. I think it's had to, the offerings that hotels give their guests in terms of food and beverage has had to adapt and has had to evolve, because partly because I think consumers, the luxury consumer, is now much more confident. They go to a city and they want to experience the real destination. They're very confident to look up online what the best restaurants are, the best bars are, to go on personal recommendations, and to go in outside of the hotel for their experiences, in a way that possibly wasn't the case. And so the hotels have had to compete with standalone bars and restaurants and food and beverage experiences in order to stay relevant and engaging to the consumer. And I also think that the consumer of a luxury hotel appreciates the atmosphere and the life that gets brought into a property. They don't want to go somewhere necessarily which is especially in cities, which is a hideaway from the city. They want to feel like they're part of the city. And those kind of, for us, and I think that, you know, the luxury consumer, the bars and the restaurants are a way of engaging with the local demographic and seeing what's going on and who, you know, understanding the place that they're in.
So we always try and attract the local customers to our hotels, because that helps to our restaurants and bars, because that helps to create the ambience and gives the hotel a local feel. If you give the restaurant operations to an outside operator, they effectively control the atmosphere in the hotel. The restaurant operation, bar operation, very much part of the hotel concept. If you're giving it to someone else who has a different approach, a different philosophy to you, then you lose a certain part of your ring to the client. So unless you have more than one restaurant, I find it very difficult to have an outside operator running the restaurant. In fact, we were discussing recently a hotel at a certain destination with a developer and owner of the hotel, insisting in having Zuma in the main restaurant operation. I said, well, fine, if you want to do that, I'm not interested, because it becomes a Zuma hotel. In fact, we run the rooms is irrelevant. And so from that point of view, restaurant and bars, the whole, create the ambience in the hotel, which is part of the culture and atmosphere that the hotel offers.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Zuma, because I was going to touch on brands for a second. And I know that we've had a discussion about this over lunch already, I know. And we talked about brands. But I wanted to hear your thoughts on the importance of branding in general, whether it's brands or branding effectively means the same thing, I guess. Tell me how much, and I'll start with you, Sir Rocco, how much relevance, or how important is it that you've focused on keeping the Rocco Forte Hotels brand as straight to the point of luxury hotels in great key cities, with, you know, everything with a focus on design, with an element of F&B. There's a from the outside, you'll humor me by believing me, there's a very clear picture in probably most people's heads when you walk into Rocco Forte of some of the things that you can expect: good service, good F&B, decent room product, great location, great city. How important is that today? Or because you know, if you listen to any of the branding experts in the so-called informed press, then they'll tell you, you know, there's no such thing as loyal customers anymore, and they'll choose location over price. Do you agree? Jude, I can see you shaking your head, so that's a clear no in my world.
Well, I mean, there are two aspects to that. We're not a huge company, and there's a lot of scope within our existing marketplace for us to continue to develop hotels. And if I'm running two brands instead of one, it divides our resources and makes it more difficult actually to make one of them stand out. So the fact that I have focus on one brand and what we're about is partly for that reason. But I'm much, you know, at the end of the day, I'm much more fascinated by the luxury market and luxury product, rather than having a number of different stratas of brands, because this is the most interesting part of the business, is the one part which is most sophisticated, and the one which is most difficult to deliver. And therefore, in competitive terms, is one where we can continue, even as a niche player, to have a significant advantage.
And if we talk about you know, the way luxury has changed over time. My question, I guess, is this, you know, has luxury developed in a different sense over time? Because we can take luxury in many different ways, right? If we talk about it, you know, there's different parts of the experience, whether that's F&B or rooms and so on. Have you felt that there's an interest in some parts of the business becoming more luxurious, perhaps, and others less? Or has it been a consistent increase across the board? Because the luxury traveler per se, and again, you know, leading back to the example of Berlin, we talked about this over lunch and before, there's just some cities where it's clearly more difficult to reach a luxury customer these days. For whatever the reason might be, right? It could be that like travel has become more of a commodity these days. Would you agree that it's not the same?
Yes, but it's at the end of the day, it's a question of demand. And I mean, to be for a luxury hotel to offer the services, it needs to offer a certain price level has to be arrived at. And there's certain markets where you can't reach that price level. In Berlin, there's over capacity. You know, you have a top average room rate of 350 to 400, whereas actually in Rome or London, or you're over 1,000, and that's you know, that's a big difference. And I mean, the problem with Berlin is access to Berlin is difficult for the international market, and it's the international market that drives the rate and enables you to deliver the services that you want to your customers. So that is a feature. And if you take Italy, for example, the attraction of Italy, with all the difficulties of doing business there, is that wherever you are in Italy, if you produce the right product, you can get the rate. Mm-hmm. And the American market, of course, is very important in driving the most important market for driving the rate. And since COVID, that's come back to Europe in a very, very strong way. And that's what's driven the rate explosion that we've seen in the last 2 years.
Well, I also think that a shift that's happened is that there are many more wealthy people able to spend money on luxury travel in a way that there used to be. There's a greater number. We have a more global economy. We have a growing, middle classes and so as a result, I think there's been a proliferation of luxury brands all trying to differentiate themselves in a way that didn't used to exist. And before you had a five-star hotel, you had a five-star hotel, and now you can have any kind of five-star hotel, and the customer is much more educated and understands the nuance of brand in a way that they didn't used to. Yeah. And so that's interesting, and that's fun to try and position yourself, you know, what your style of luxury means. And I think that's a big change.
But I mean, what you've seen, of course, also is this sort of amalgamation that's taken place, this sort of consolidation that's taken place, the Marriotts and the Accors as well, were running 30 to 40 brands, different brands. I mean, I find that as a sort of horrifying concept.
Scenario.
And how do you run a business? Where do you focus? I found that in the old Trust Us 40 business, which was we were from budget to luxury. We were in popular catering to running the George Sank and the Plaza Tenet. And our luxury hotel general managers didn't want to be associated with 40, which was seen very much as a middle market brand. And as soon as I got into a position where I could actually influence things, yeah, I created a separate division for the luxury hotels. Mm-hmm. How many luxury, so-called luxury brands does Marriott have? How many so-called luxury brands does Accor have? And how do you distinguish between each one? And you develop a more corporate culture, and the advantage I think we have, and what I think one of my main objectives is to somehow be able to communicate how distinctive our product is from the rest of the luxury products that are in the market, which a lot of these companies become so huge, they become very corporate in their approach. And it's not the same intimate approach that we take to the detail of running the business.
Because also there's that constant tension. It's not that straightforward. There's a constant tension between delivering a clear brand identity, but also delivering local individual detail and touches and authenticity, which really create the true luxury experience for the modern consumer. And that's very hard to get across. Especially if you have several brands. I mean, it's hard enough when you have one brand. So I don't know how they end up with very cookie cutter kind of rigid concepts and rules, which you don't have, which aren't necessarily right for every market.
Yeah, I have a confession to make, Lydia, if I may. I worked for the Roccoforte collection at one point in time, and this was, you know, granted, this was many, many years ago, I will admit, and it was only an internship when I was at university, but I worked in what was at the time the Villa Kennedy in Frankfurt. It was just 6 months, and I worked at the JFK's bar, which I'm sure you remember, and I remember the attention that you, at a very early stage with the hotels, were putting into certain elements like the design. And it's funny because I was talking to my mom about this over dinner two nights ago when I told her I was going to meet the two of you, and there are some things I will never forget about the hotel. And my question is this, and it's to you first, Lydia, if I may. How important is it, I'm going to call it, forgive me, Sir Rocco, how important is that Sir Rocco or maybe Roccoforte vibe in the hotels? That feeling when you walk into a hotel, which I guess is influenced by many parts, right? There's the service, there's probably many different things that affect that. There's potentially a smell, there's the things you see. How important do you reckon that's been over time? And especially also in terms of the F&B outlets, because I remember at the time, and I'm sure this hasn't changed, there was a consistent review process as well of whether the concept still made sense in the location and so on and so forth, and you know, whether there was potentially a need for change. And you guys have always been, or at least come across that way, as very rigorous if something wasn't working, right? There was no hesitation here or anything of the sort. Has that helped you, do you reckon, over time staying around? Because there have been other companies who have, over time, disappeared, who tried, you know, similar ways of doing in the luxury hospitality business.
I mean, yes, I think it's very, I mean, it's the essence of everything that we do is trying to define, to pay attention to the detail and trying to make sure that all of the elements that fit, that represent our brand are present in every hotel. And you can only do that by looking at every individual hotel on a case by case basis and really being engaged and involved. And I think all of us as family members are regularly in the hotels and constantly in the hotels, because it's the only way that you can really understand whether the detail is right and the essence is right. You can look at the figures, you can understand a lot, but unless you're there,
it's hard to tell.
You don't know. So I think that sort of focused attention to detail to every aspect is what really has set the brand apart, and that Dad was very, very conscious about from the beginning.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you have, and the fact that we're in the hotels, and there's obviously my sister Olga, myself, and now my children, between us, we're in the hotels and we're visible. And people working in the hotels understand how much we care and how it's important. And obviously, with our induction process and so on, we put a lot of effort into what our philosophy is, particularly in relation to the customer, the history, where we've come from. It means, so there's more to it than just that hotel, and you're working for something bigger than just that particular hotel. All that particular hotel is very important, and it's part of a bigger, but it's part of a bigger culture, which is what makes us successful in delivering to our guests.
Lydia, before we turned on the recording, you shared a couple of secrets with me, which we're not going to put on the air, but you did mention that you're working on some new concepts in the F&B space, and there's always something going on here nor there. Can you give me a sneak peek at how the Roccoforte Collection F&B team works on concepts? How do I need to picture that happening? Is it a group effort? Is it Dad comes in and says, I like this in a place that I've visited, and then we see how we implement it? Is it you visiting? Is it somebody else visiting? Is it Charles visiting? How do you go about creating something new in a company like yours, and walk me through that process.
Well, I mean, we've evolved, or I'm evolving the team a little bit, because we didn't really have much of an in-house team. We started with Fulvio Perangelini, who's this great consultant, he works for us full-time. He's this great chef who had this two Michelin-starred restaurant in Tuscany called Gambero Rosso, which was always in the top world's best 50 San Pellegrino list. And it's the only fine dining restaurant that Dad ever really liked, I think.
Is that true, Sirocco?
Yes, because, I mean, the issue with all this Michelin-starred business is that the food becomes more important than the customer. And it's a bit like going to church. You know, you've got to genuflect and cross yourself several times over when you go in. And I mean, there's some of these Michelin-star chefs who've kicked the customer out when he's asked to have some extra salt to put on the food. You know, how dare he criticize the food? It's not about the customer. Restaurants are about a customer and looking after the customer. And the thing about Fulvio is that his philosophy has always been simplicity is not the point of departure, it's the point of arrival. And the simpler the food, the more difficult it is to deliver to a correct standard, which is a little bit the overall philosophy of my company. And he's, apart from Marco Pierre White, he's the only chef I've come across in my life who has such an acute understanding of food and natural flavors of food and a way of bringing them out without messing the food about and being, you know, creating something, has to create something new all the time. And that's the approach. I want busy restaurants where there's a good atmosphere, the food is good and delivered on a consistent basis. I don't want to be sort of esoteric approach to food that Michelin star delivers.
And I think that holds fast with the modern consumer. You know, they're very spoiled. They're eating out a lot. They're eating out regularly. You know, occasionally, I'm more open-minded than you. I do like the occasional experiential dining, fine dining experience. But I think that it can get, it gets tiring, and you eat too much food, and that's actually not that funny. Then you want to go to somewhere where the offering is simple but of excellent quality, and Fulvio delivered that really well. So he started our F&B philosophy in the company when he joined, I think maybe more than 15 years ago now.
15 years ago.
And he's absolutely brilliant chef. And so I've just tried a little bit to build a structure around him that can then support that philosophy growing in, as we grow, because otherwise he's a one man band. And I think now we're starting to try and develop, more Italian concepts based on his philosophy of food that we can use in an intelligent and nuanced way in more than one property, always with local touches, always with local ingredients, always that suits the local market, but at least trying to develop some entire concepts which are not just about the menu, but also about the style of service, the uniforms, the interiors, which is now also important, I think, for a consumer.
Lydia, I need to ask, because, you know, clearly you're an F&B expert. Do you ever get annoyed with all the new food trends and every little nuance there is now with people being vegan, pescatarian? I mean, vegetarians have been around for a while, and I think, you know, everybody's accepted that. But there's now, you know, there's no glucose, there's no gluten and everything else that comes with it. Does that, you know, I guess the question is, does that hinder creativity sometimes, and especially in what you do with creating concepts and looking at F&B angles? Or does it provide a nice challenge where you say, okay, we can mess around a little bit with this and see how creative we get while, you know, serving everybody with all the different variances there is to it?
No, I think, I mean, the reality of that is that we always try and have the healthier option, the lighter option available, because people do want to eat more and more in that way, and people are more aware of intolerances, and I think that they're probably real, even if some people take it, you know, people take it to an extreme. But the reality is that the consumer or the customers, the guests that come to our hotels, by and large, when they go out, they want to have the things that they don't eat every day. And so we always have non-alcoholic cocktails on the menu in all of our bars. They never get ordered. We always have plant-based menu, vegetarian dishes. They rarely get ordered. And so I think we have to be also, it's the nature of our demographic. You know, we have a broad range of luxury consumer, and they want convenience and they want comfort and they want what they want in that moment. And so we can't be too niche in the food and beverage things that we offer. Mm. But we've definitely made a conscious effort to always have gluten-free options on every breakfast buffet, at least 2 or 3 a la carte dishes on the breakfast menu, which are healthier and so on, because that's the general direction of travel, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sort of whole exaggeration. There's an exaggeration of everything these days. Everything is taken to sort of, you know, people take these intolerance tests. I took an intolerance test and found I was intolerant to pineapple. I've been eating pineapple all my life, and it's never done me any harm.
Really? Well, my son's allergic to pineapple. Maybe it comes from you.
And which is nonsense. I mean, it completely it doesn't do me any harm at all. The if I eat it, so you know, there's an exaggeration, and I must say it rather pains me the whole thing. And the thing is not to exaggerate in everything, and if you have a balanced diet, you know. We've been meat eaters for centuries. You know, you can't stop just eating meat. You know, and it's bad for you, actually. And people who I go to, sort of, I'm a very sort of non-traditional medicine type of person. So I think, you know, it's very dangerous, because today anything gets promoted very. Very quickly, and people are led into certain directions where they shouldn't go. It's got to be a balanced approach.
It's a reaction to excess, though. And so it's a way of coming back from what has become, by and large, very unhealthy living choices. And if you look, I remember when my sister and I did this program called Rocco Forte Nourish, where we collaborated with local nutritionists in every hotel. And we wanted to create healthy menus at every touch point, from the mini bar to the breakfast buffet and so on. And when we were looking in Italy for these healthy personalities, we couldn't find them, because there was no need for them, because people have had a healthy and balanced diet, you know, using the fresh olive oil,
which is so
using
important.
Fresh seasonal local ingredients forever. And so there wasn't a need to sort of react to, you know, people were aware that you don't eat processed food, that you don't eat meat every meal, that you don't eat, but you have a healthy, balanced diet. Whereas actually this whole like healthy lifestyle food thing came from America, where you had these terrible health problems because the culture of food just became so perverse, basically.
Yeah. I mean, we could do a whole podcast just on eating habits, but we'll close that there. And Sorok, I'm going to move back to you. I do have to ask, because it's astonishing what you've built over time, and I do want to ask about the family. I realize that you said, you know, Olga's kids are now involved as well, and your kids are not only kids anymore, but grown-ups, as you know, we can see, and very much involved in the business. So just out of curiosity, I'm sure the people out there want to know, what happens when there's a family meeting at the Rocco Forte Collection and not everybody agrees? Walk me through how that process goes. How does that, you know, everybody's laughing, you know, how does that work? Because there must have been plenty of meetings where you had a different idea than maybe Lydia or Irene or Olga or Charles or whoever. Walk me through a family meeting. First of all, do they exist? Is that a thing, or is that just an urban myth, and it's, you know, it's business meetings with other parts of the team as in any other company?
Not really. I mean, if there are family meetings on an informal basis. Okay. You know, obviously, I have any organization has to have highly professional executives to make it work. Sense. I have a great team in Rocco Forte Hotel outside the family. So we have certain processes that we go through in our decision making process. And obviously, we exchange ideas, and obviously, I have to be the ultimate arbiter.
He's definitely the ultimate arbiter, yeah.
But I am influenced because I'm not. I've always been a listener, mm-hmm. to some degree. Sometimes it takes me longer than people would like to come round to a new concept. But then, But then it's a good thing because I've debated it with myself. And if I finally agree that it's the right thing, it must be the right thing. You know?
I think by and large, we kind of agree. I mean, my philosophy of hospitality has been his, you know, that he taught me what I know about hospitality and my aunt as well. And obviously a lot of other people that have been in the business and that I've worked with in the past. But I think there is a slight, probably the alignment is more generational. Like I would say that you and Olga pretty much agree on almost everything. And Charles and I pretty much agree on almost everything. And then there's a bit of debate between two. Yeah. And our sister as well.
But I mean, you know, with Charles, I mean, his work is now running the development side and finding new sites and new properties and so on. And I would really disagree with any, you know, he seems to have a natural instinct for, which obviously he's developed a bit through training of what a hotel should be, how it should be delivered. He can go to a building and see this will work, that won't work, which is something I had in developing. I think he's better at it than me, actually. And I will, you know, I will, you know, I'd say you get on with it, you know, very often. Lydia has a more difficult role in a way with food and beverage because you have the hotel general manager who runs the hotel, has responsibility. You can't do things completely above his head. So there's a much more persuasive element to what she has to do in actually bringing new projects to fruition.
It's much more political, but also it's operations, which in a way is much more complex.
Yes.
You obviously rely on the local team to deliver the service and the experience for your guests, and you're not there all the time, and so they have to breathe it and buy into it and believe in it, otherwise it wouldn't happen.
Would you say, Sir Rocco, that the fact that you've had the family involved for so long, and the fact that, you know, forgive me for saying this, but there are generations who clearly have grown up under certain influences, would you say that your style of leadership has changed over time, or has it influenced your style of leadership, getting these influences from within the family? I realize this is a very philosophical question, but what are your thoughts on that?
No, but I think in relation to my family, you know, I work for my father, so I understand the, you know, I understand the nuances from the other side, you know. So I think as a result of that, I'm a bit different to my father, the way I've dealt with my children. Obviously they've grown up in this business, you know, as youngsters. They worked in their school holidays and university holidays, spent part of the time working in the business. They've been part of it as it's grown up, and they've learned from that as well. And so I think they feel to agree very much part of the process. And I don't think, you know, there's no sort of artificial approach to it. And I think we're all pretty open in terms of what we say and what we think about what we think, and you know, in a perfectly civilized way. So it's this good debate and good interchange, which is actually what you need in a good business.
I've heard a rumor, or not even probably a rumor at all, but I've heard that if you travel to one of the Roccoforte Collection properties, Sir Rocco, after you leave, you send a memo or a list of things that you've felt and seen and experienced. Is that true?
Yes.
And I find that extremely fascinating and very much in touch with the teams on the ground. So walk me through your, and this, I realize this may seem obvious to you, but walk me through why you do that. What's your reasoning behind it?
Well, I mean, the reason... I visit a hotel. There are a number of reasons why I will visit a hotel on a regular basis. One is to understand what's going on, and you get to know the people working in the hotel, the heads of department, their effectiveness or not, and therefore that makes you a much better decision maker at the top. When things come up the line. I also visit to show myself and enable people to understand that they're part of a bigger group and that there's a philosophy and culture and so on related to that, which I which I'm promoting, obviously, when I visit the hotel. And then when I visit a hotel, I get round the hotel. I meet a lot of the staff. I spend time talking to them. They hear directly from them. So there's a motivational aspect as well to all that. But obviously, in any hotel you will go in, whether it's best run hotel or not, there are always issues and things, and that will come out of discussion. So I, effectively, it's a record of what we've discussed. And obviously, with individual hotels, there's a regional guy in charge of the hotel, so I can't cut across the line. But I set out my points, I think, of weakness, any ideas I might have of how we can improve things, and it's copied into the guy who's in charge, if you like, and then they can use that to look at issues or actually debate them with me if they want to.
All right, very, very interesting. Lydia, if we look at that as an example and kind of the way that Dad has, I'm going to call Dad myself now, very exciting, has built this business over time. Walk me through your decision process of joining. Was there ever a debate? Was there ever a plan B? I don't know, lawyer, banker, doctor, or was that always your mission to join the company at some point?
Yeah, honestly, I studied history at university and I didn't really know what I was going to do. And I had done all of these internships in different spheres, and I worked in a magazine, I worked in marketing, in advertising. I thought about, all of my friends were going into management consulting and finance, and I did this one work experience working at the Wolseley as an assistant maitre d', and it was the first time I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I loved restaurants, and I love what makes a restaurant tick and what makes a restaurant work. And I got an energy from doing that, which I didn't get from other jobs. And so, but I think in the back of my mind, there was also a sense that was an area of the business that I could move into. And I think Dad just kind of capitalized on a moment of me cashing, I'd cashed up the restaurant that I was managing at 1 or 2 in the morning, and I was having breakfast at 7 the next day, and he said, well, why don't you come and work for me for a bit? And I said, okay, that sounds good. So it just worked out, really. Yeah.
Guys, just like that, 40 minutes have blown away. So let's spend just a couple of minutes here before we end on the future. I've been fortunate enough to travel the world a bit myself, and especially the hospitality world. And I've been around, and obviously there's a big buzz going on in the Middle East at the moment. And then there came some big news recently. And Sir Rocco, can you tell me where you see the Roccoforte Hotels in 5 years? Just very generally, it doesn't have to be in any specific idea. But 5 years from now, if we meet again in this room, which I believe is room 319 at the Browns, which I can very much recommend, by the way. It's a beautiful room, ladies and gents. I know you can't see it, but it's a great one. What would you, we're having coffee at this very table in 5 years. What would you have liked to have happened?
Well, what we've done is there's been a substantial investment in the company by the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, PIF, who've bought out. We had another minority shareholder, 23% shareholder, which was CDP, Cassa Depositi e Prestiti, and I had a number of my sisters who inherited shares, because when I set up the business, the first place, my father invested some money, and they're not involved, and they'd rather have left. So they've largely been bought out in the process of this deal, and there's been an injection of money into the company as well. And with my sister Olga, I still have control of the business. And so it's actually, it's put a big value on the business. It's raised our profile significantly across the world. The fact that we have such a strong partner also makes us more attractive to banks, to developers. And so it's given us effectively a new lease of life, or even a better lease of life than we had before going forward. So I see this as a big opportunity to significantly grow the business over the next five or 6 years. We have a significant concentration at the moment in Italy. 52% of our turnover at the moment is in Italy. We have opportunities, a lot more opportunities to continue to grow in Italy. And I think we're in a position where we are sort of one of the largest luxury operators and have the opportunity of becoming the most noted luxury operator in the country, offering complete coverage. So I don't want to stop that. But we should be in the United States. We should be in Paris, for example. We should be in Spain, where we're not. And obviously, the Middle East is an important and growing area, and we're not there. This deal offers us the opportunity of actually developing in the Middle East. I did have before the financial crisis. I had sort of six projects in the Middle East. And then with the financial crisis, then the so-called Arab Spring, the whole thing disappeared. And that never went ahead. So this is an opportunity to really get back into the area, which is, of course, a big customer base for us. A lot of our business comes from that part of the world. The presence there would help us to grow that business. As the United States, probably 40% of our business comes out of the United States, although we don't have one single property there. To have a presence there would help the whole profile of the group. So widening the geographical aspect is important. One of the focuses at the moment is on service delivery. How do we improve the service delivery? How do we make ourselves better than anybody else? With the sort of explosion in hotel room rates, average room rates, a lot of people taking advantage of that. They haven't changed the approach to the customer. I think the people who are going to maintain those rates are the ones who can deliver that extra special bit of service. And so I'm focusing very strongly on that at the moment. And then the third strand is our brand. I think we have an established brand, but I don't think it's as well known as it should be and could be. And I think we have to find a way of communicating the differentials we have with other luxury properties much more effectively than we do now. So that's another main area of focus for me at the present time.
I'm going to close, guys, with two very simple questions, because I can't possibly talk to the two of you without asking for your best or funniest or most memorable, or whatever you might want to call it, hospitality moment. Is there any moment, and I'll start with Lydia, because I'm sure Sirocco has about 400 to share, but is there any particular moment that you thought, oh my God, I didn't ever think it was going to be possible that this happens? You know, it can be F&B related, can be related to Dad, one of Dad's meetings, something that happened in one of the hotels. Is there anything that springs to mind when you say, how the hell did that just happen?
Many moments I'm not going to share here, I think.
Well, I don't know. It's difficult. It's difficult. I got off the top of my head, it's difficult to remember. There's sort of, obviously, I dismissed the chef the day before we opened the hotel in Berlin, for example. Oh, wow. That was a sort of, the general manager didn't know what to do. I had my first budget meeting with the two German hotels, Berlin and Frankfurt, at the same time, and they presented this budget, which was pretty pathetic budget. So I said to them, if this is all you can do, I don't need you. And I got up and left the room, and they didn't know what to do. but I'm not as sort of I'm much more patient now than I was in those early days. I don't know. There's all sorts of. There's a customer at the Astoria hotel, who was ex-KGB and went to his bedroom and started looking to see where the bugs were in the room. And he rolled back the carpet, and then he saw a sort of thing on the ground underneath the carpet, and he unscrewed the screws and so on, and took the thing out, and so there wasn't a bug there anyway. They put the carpet back, and next day he went down to the lobby in the morning, and the general manager said, "How were you all right, Mr. whatever his name was?" And he said, "Oh, yes, I had a marvelous night's sleep." He says, "Oh, thank God for that." He said, "The customer in the room below had the chandelier fall on his bed."
Oh, God. Yeah, those are the kind of stories, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so many like that. You have some amazing customer stories. The I can't remember which hotel. I think that was in Manchester, actually, when you had the Larry. There was this regular... night sleepwalker who would come out. I think he stayed for like 3 or 4 nights, and every night he came out of the room completely naked and got locked out of the room and had to go down to the concierge and get the key to go back up again. And plenty of like rock bands. And didn't Robbie Williams throw a television out over the balcony into the lobby of the...
Yes, in Cardiff.
Of Cardiff.
There was a Russian customer who rang up the hotel, was coming to the hotel to see in Rome, and said he wanted to find a wife. Mm. And the concierge found him a wife, actually.
Yes, before we go, guys, with the request for short answers, 3 very short questions, it's kind of a thing we always do here at the end of the podcast. Your favorite city to travel for leisure? So not business, doesn't necessarily have to be part of the Roccaforte collection either, but your favorite city to travel to for leisure, where would that be? And I'll start with you again, Lydia. Is there one?
I like to go to new places all the time, but if I have to go back regularly to a city for leisure, probably Rome.
Sir Rocco?
Yes, I'm afraid I have the same...
The same answer, yes?
The same answer, yes. I mean, I don't... It's difficult to say your favourite city, but I mean, I'm always amazed when I go back to Rome and see the same... The thing about Rome is you're living with antiquity, you know, on a regular basis. There's no city quite like that. There's so much, you know, remains of things that 2,000 years ago, right there in the middle of the city. And you're always somehow surprised to see they're still there. And I suppose the other city, which is amazing in a slightly different way, is Venice, because Venice is, you know, completely, in a way, artificial construct. But it was an artificial construct of hundreds of years ago. And that always remained, you know, you fly into the airport and you can fly over the Grand Canal, you see the thing. You have the same sensation every time in a way that you don't have quite with other cities.
And also actually Palermo, where we opened Villa Egea, getting to know that city I've really enjoyed, because it's this amazing melting pot of different cultures. You've had these invading peoples for hundreds of years coming, bringing their cultures and bringing their architecture. And so you've got this great mix, and you've also got this amazing kind of high-low experience. It's this grandeur where every invading people brought their own aristocracy. And then in a way, the city became a bit sort of dilapidated and run down. So it has this amazing charm to it, with this contrast between the grandeur and the high and the low and the different cultures. And it's got amazing culture as well, and it's developing really well.
And also, of course, it has our most beautiful hotel, Villa Egea, and one of the most beautiful hotels in the world, I think, without any doubt. Which we've brought back. We restored. It was very run down, badly run, and we brought it back to its initial glory, where it had all the heads of states of Europe staying in it before the First World War. And that's one of the exciting things and satisfying things about what we do is you take a building which was a hotel, is no longer like the Hotel de Russie, and you make it a hotel again, and you create life and employment there. You know, and I, whenever I go to the Hotel de Russie and sit in the restaurant garden there, I think back to the first day I saw it. And it was, you know, I went in February, it was a sunny day, and there's this building that had been empty for 8 years, it had been the headquarters of Rai Italian Television. And I think back then, and I couldn't believe how beautiful it was, and nothing had happened there for 8 years. And I was able to persuade the owners to let me do a hotel there. And I sit there and see it thriving with people and the Roman. A lot of Romans use it as a sort of watering hole. And it sort of gives me a big sense of pride there.
I was going to say, is that a moment? Is that a moment where even Sirocco is proud and says, yes, that was, you know, that was quite the achievement?
Yes, I also see all the things that are wrong and should be improving. But...
That being said, give me a hotel, both of you, that you enjoy, that you like for whatever reason, that is not part of the Roccoforte collection.
There are lots of amazing hotels. I mean, I loved going to stay at Villa Treville in Amalfi because it's only 16 suites and it has a wonderful history and it's very bespoke and it's in this beautiful spot and we don't have anything there. I like the grandeur of the Bristol and the breakfast and the Bristol and the great croissants and the great hot chocolate and the things that make it, you know, you feel like you're in Paris when you're there. What about?
Yeah, I mean, I think favorite. I mean, I you know, I like the Plaza Athénée in Paris. It's a hotel that we used to own in the old company, and so they always treat me as if I still own it. You know, which is rather
which is
rather always very kind to me there. Villa d'Este in Como is a fantastic situation, you know, on the lake there. It's sort of a unique property. And I like the Beverly Hills Hotel because it encapsulates Beverly Hills and has gone through different sort of ownerships, different periods of good management and bad management. But I've always liked going there because it's the one hotel that's actually, Beverly Hills is built around it. In fact, it was the first sort of classical development with hotel, then houses were sold around it. So I like that for that reason.
The final question. Give me something the Italians are much better at than the Brits.
Food, fashion, how to live.
Yeah, and the other way around. Give me something the Brits are much better at than the Italians. Is there anything?
Yes, I mean, yes, there is. I think there's a better sense of discipline, mm-hmm. although we seem to be starting to lose losing it. And also, I liked stiff upper lip, although that's starting to. Princess Diana destroyed that to some degree, this over emotional approach that we have in the world, and Italians are, of course, over expansive in many ways, and I like that sort of certain sort of conservatism that you found in British culture, and of course, you know, the whole the fact that it's the birthplace of democracy, really, in the modern world. Not forgetting Greece, but I mean, in the modern idiom, it's the birthplace of democracy, and therefore the traditions and standards that stem to that, which sort of prevail despite of the awful sort of political management that we've had over the last sort of 15 years.
And I love the British ability to be concise. The whole point about the English language is that you should be able to say things. Well-written English should be able to say things quickly, with the right vocabulary, which drives me mad in Italy because any meeting takes about 3 hours.
Yes, and also the tradition of after-dinner speaking and keeping things short and to the point and also amusing, which doesn't exist in Italy. In the same way, and people stand up without knowing what they're going to say and speak for 3 hours, you know.
So Rocco, Lydia, thank you so much. It's been a breath of fresh air. Just like that, an hour's gone by. I'm going to get in trouble again for dragging this on way longer than it should have been, but it was so much fun. I cannot thank you both enough for this. It's been great. Thank you for sharing some of the insights, and I wish you both nothing but the best, both family-wise and also business-wise for the upcoming years. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you,
you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to share your thoughts on this episode and everything else that is going on at Smack with us by checking out our website at smack.media or connect with us on LinkedIn, YouTube, or Instagram. We'll see you next time.